I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. John Boyko joins me again, the best-selling author and historian, has just published a new book, Sir John's Echo, The Voice for a Stronger Canada. It's a stimulating book that looks at Sir John A. Macdonald's life and career, and more substantially, the legacy of Macdonald through the last 150 years. His influence is unmistakable, and we see that through the two world wars, through to the Quebec crisis, the patriation of the Constitution, as well as recent years, how his vision has been appropriated by Justin Trudeau or ignored and dismantled by Stephen Harper. In the book, John discusses how the federal government should retain more political power so as to build a stronger national voice when one is needed more and more both at home and abroad. I'll get him to tell us why, as well as how Canadian values are needed in the discourse today, and just what those Canadian values are. John Boyko is the author of 6 books, including his most recent 3, which he was on this program with, Bennett, the Rebel Who Changed and Challenged the Nation, Blood and Daring, How Canada Fought the Civil War, and Cold Fire, Kennedy's Northern Front, which has just been nominated for a major book prize. JohnBoyko.com is the website for more. The Twitter handle is at John W. Boyko. This new book is published by Dundurn, which is part of their Point of View series, edited by Patrick Boyer. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, John Boyko. Mr. Boyko, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Excellent.
This is, as I was telling you just before we started, such an engaging book. And as we turn, or Canada turns 150 this year, it's a great way to look back as well as look ahead. What did you want us, the reader, to think about as we're headed into this significant anniversary?
Well, I believe that Canada is more than a country. I believe that the strength is that we are an ongoing conversation. And that conversation happens every time we have an election, every time there's a new law proposed, every time there is something that happens that either swells us with pride or brings us to tears in the country or the world. We have a conversation about who we are and who we wish to be. And that's good. That's as it should be. We should be reinventing ourselves all of the time. And every time that conversation takes place, I believe, it is all about power and where power should rest, whether it should rest with this level of government or another, or with this style of leader or another. And what I wanted to do was to add something to that conversation, because there's going to be a lot of introspection happening this year in our 150th birthday. And I wanted that conversation about power to take place with a reflection upon who the founders of our country, what our the founders of our country believed that power should look like. And so that was what Dundurn Press, who published Sir John's Echo, asked me to do, to write a book that would investigate that concept and add to the debate, in fact, stir debate. In fact, what I was asked to do was to write a book that about half the people who read it would disagree with me, which is quite a challenge.
And do you think that the half or so that would disagree with you would probably be from another part of the country than you are?
It could well be, because I am from Ontario, and what I am arguing is that Sir John A. Macdonald and all of the founders from the 4 original provinces believed that dominant power should rest with the federal government. The federal government should have sufficient power and capacity to build the country and to respond to emergencies and to speak for the country. And what the book does is carries an examination of where that vision has gone, and it looks at it in terms of provinces that grew increasingly powerful and believe that provincial capitals is where dominant power should rest, and that they should have more power and that the federal government should have less. So therefore, especially, I am guessing, many people in Alberta, many people in Quebec, would disagree with me because they would disagree with Sir John's original vision.
But don't you think, John, that the country has changed? I mean, you spoke of 4 original provinces. There are now 10 and 3 territories. In the last 25 years, the rise of cities in terms of their influence as opposed to provinces now, I mean, that's happening around the world, not just Canada, but, I mean, you know, cities. The mayors in a lot of the large cities are probably more prominent than the premiers of the provinces that they're in.
Well, absolutely, and that's something that Sir John Jacquot does, is it looks at the evolution of that idea, and it looks at the evolution of the idea as more federal-provincial agreements were made with respect to a great number of policies that, and programs that we now see as our birthright, healthcare, pensions, and others of that nature, which allowed the provinces to play an important, essential role in our country, in our confederation. And when you bring up cities, that's an essential part of the change that has happened, too, that I reflect in the book, because you're quite right that at the time, cities were not even really considered when the original constitution was written. There were very few of them, and they were very small. And when Sir John and the founders created the constitution, they created the provinces as simply glorified municipalities. And now we have municipalities that are, well, more populous. Toronto is more people than Prince Edward Island, and in many ways more powerful. So absolutely, it's part of the evolution of power in our country that is reflected in the book, and that is must be part of the conversation that I'm talking about.
Did the fathers of Confederation, did our founders, did, could they have foreseen, Sir John Aim in particular, foreseen where the country is 150 years after the founding of this country?
I don't think they could have seen it in detail, and I don't think he would have pretended to be able to see it in detail, and that's why the Constitution is written in such a way that it gave great flexibility. But even in the flexibility that was written, knowing that progress would continue, technological progress, and that progress would continue in a number of ways that he couldn't have imagined, like we were just talking about with the growth of cities, he wrote the Constitution, primarily him, but all of them, wrote the Constitution in a way that would maintain that vision. One of the clauses that was put into the Constitution, for example, is a residual clause that said anything that comes up in the future that we haven't anticipated will go automatically, that power will automatically rest with the federal government. That's why the federal government regulates airports. That's why the federal government regulates the Internet. Sir John couldn't have foreseen those things, but he foresaw that there would be changes, and therefore it would happen. But if we were to somehow bring Sir John back to life, put him in Ottawa, I think we could spend a day talking about the technological changes that have happened. I think we could spend a day with him talking about the rise of cities and the incredibly powerful premiers and provinces that are around now. But he would still see the power struggle between the federal government and the provincial governments, and he would still see the power relations in the House of Commons as not a whole lot different.
The founding of this country took place at a time where the threat of American annexation was very real. I remember talking to Richard Gwynne when he wrote those two books on MacDonald about how it was very tenuous, that Canada could have been part of the United States. Was that something that motivated MacDonald to, say, get away from the United States or to avoid being subsumed by them, in terms of how he and the other fathers of Confederation wrote the documents that founded this country, the Constitution in particular?
Right. Well, there's two parts to your question. The first part is absolutely they were motivated by the American Civil War. Something that had been talked about, Confederation had been talked about for a great number of years, and it had never really gone anywhere because it had no traction due to England still being very supportive of the colonies, the colonies still flopping along with their really dysfunctional governments and their economies that were beginning to grow a little bit, slowly but growing. But two things happened. One, Britain's Little Englanders group was becoming more and more powerful in Britain, saying we want to get rid of the colonies and get rid of the economic and military entrapments that are part of running these colonies on our own. So they were trying to push us out the door. At the same time, the American Civil War had been going on since 1861, and they had been butchering themselves to the tune where over 700,000 Americans were killed, and there was a great number of American newspaper editors and generals and senators who were saying, we are going to invade Canada due to a number of things that Canada and Britain had done during the war. So, yeah, those two threats were very much in play. So we needed to create ourselves in order to save ourselves. Now, that said, the second part of your question is, did that affect the writing of the Constitution? And absolutely it did. From the British, what the founders did was they took the notion that we would remain loyal to the monarchy, and they took the notion that we would have a parliamentary democracy. We would have a House of Commons, and we would have a Senate. We couldn't have a House of Lords. We didn't have any Lords, but we would have the Senate. So we took the trappings of the British government. But from the Americans, we took the idea that we would have a written constitution, unlike Britain that does not. And from the Americans, mostly at the behest of Quebec and New Brunswick, we would have a federal system with two levels of government. But this is where the Americans provided an absolutely negative example. So what you asked in your question is, did it affect? It absolutely affected, because Sir John was clear that the problem in the American Constitution that had been the primary result of the Civil War breaking out in the first place was too much power given to the states. Mm. And in fact, he said in a speech, he said, the American Constitution commenced at the wrong end. He said, here we have adopted a different system. We have strengthened the general government. We have given the general legislature all the great subjects of legislation. And if you looked at Section 91 and 92 of our Constitution, you can see it is absolutely saying that the dominant power will be the federal government. The prime minister will appoint the senators. They will appoint the lieutenant governors. They can disallow laws that provinces might pass. A number of things that we would find outrageous at the time, but that in 1864, when they were writing this, deep in the heart of the American Civil War, they saw the American example as so negative because they had too much power in the state, so therefore we're giving the federal government all the power that mattered.
Looking at it objectively, do you think it's ours is the better system than, say, the other two?
In terms of where power is located,
yeah.
Yes, I believe that the federal government must have the power and capacity in order to build the country, and we build the country through public works, the railroad, the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Trans-Canada Highway. We build it through public works, and we build it through policy such as the pension plan, the health care plan, and many other plans, policies that we could talk about. And the federal government must have the power and capacity to save the country in times of crisis, whether it's the First or Second World War or the Great Depression or wildfires in Fort McMurray. It is the federal government that has the ability to save the country when there is an emergency. So absolutely, I believe that putting dominant power in the hands of the federal government and allowing the federal government to speak for Canada is the proper way. With respect to running a federal system as opposed to the system that they have in Great Britain, I believe that the federal system is essential. In fact, without the federal system, where there is responsibilities in the provincial levels, that we wouldn't have had the country in the first place, because Quebec and New Brunswick, for two of them, wouldn't have agreed to it, and others probably wouldn't have agreed to join.
And geographically, I guess it's ideal too, isn't it? Because we're a much bigger country than, say,
absolutely essential.
England.
Because there are policies in British Columbia that don't work in Nova Scotia, and for that reason, the provinces are essential. See, nowhere in my book do I suggest that the premiers are not patriots, because they are, and nowhere in my book do I suggest that the provinces are not important. They're essential, but the question is a matter of degrees. Where should dominant power stay? And the argument comes down to, I believe, that every time that we have been at our best as a country, then the federal government has acted responsibly and progressively and been a voice for all of Canada. Every time that we have been at our peril, it is almost always when provincial premiers have been pushing to slice off parts of federal power for themselves, or sabotaging the efforts of the federal government that was doing things that ultimately were in the country's best interest.
So where we are today, where power lies both federally and provincially, how do you get provinces that are rather powerful today to give up some of the powers that they ought to make the central government stronger?
Well, I don't know that you need necessarily for them to give up powers. nor do I believe is it necessary for the federal government to gather more power to himself on a structural level. I don't think we're talking about constitutional changes or anything like that. I believe what we have is the marriage of structural power, if you will, constitutional power, and leadership. And we can go back to Prime Minister Harper, for example, and many people like him. Many people believe that he was a great leader and had great policies, and that's fine. Many people believe he was a bad person with bad policies, and that's fine. It's up to them. But what we saw Prime Minister Harper do with no constitutional changes, working within the structure that he was given, basically make a number of moves that weakened the federal government by, let's see what he did with respect to health care and increasing the amount of money that he gave to health care, but cut the strings and cut the federal ability to control how that money was spent. He got rid of the national daycare program that the Martin government had put into place. He had done a great number of things that essentially starved the beast, lobotomized the beast, and emasculated the beast. And had he been in power for another generation or even another couple of terms, then that change probably would have been permanent. But what Mr. Trudeau has been doing, and again, like him, don't like him, like his policies or don't like his policies, it doesn't matter. What he has been doing is increasing the power of the federal government so that it looks very much like the vision of Sir John's. He's been doing that with respect to the pensions, where he led the restructuring of the pensions. He led the restructuring of the health care program, and everyone except Brad Wall of Saskatchewan is joining in. He has also led with respect to climate change, where he said there will be this policy across Canada in order to implement the climate change policies. And so what we had then is a situation where with Mr. Harper, nothing structurally changed with respect to power, but it changed with respect to leadership, and we are seeing it again with Mr. Trudeau. So I don't think that we need to talk about power shifts where the federal government needs to get more or the provinces need to get more or be given less. It is all in a matter of leadership respecting the original vision of our founders.
When you think of prime ministers that we've had and you look at how they perceive themselves, and I guess inevitably whenever you're in a certain job or position, you compare yourself to your predecessors. How do prime ministers since Macdonald view him?
View Macdonald?
Yeah.
What we had was the Prime Minister Diefenbaker, more than any other, was in such admiration of Sir John. He had a great statue of Sir John, about a 2-foot statue, beside his desk in his office. He collected Sir John memorabilia. He read widely everything he could about Sir John. So that was almost a hero worship. I think a good number of prime ministers looked on Sir John with a certain degree of admiration because of what he was able to do. They knew that everything he did and said as prime minister was going to be a precedent for everyone that followed. So they looked at him with a great deal of admiration. But while Sir John was a great leader, and he was a hail fellow, well met, and he was a great raconteur and a tremendous charmer, we can't be looking at him simply with rose-colored glasses. We have to remember that he did a great deal about which we should feel great shame, mm-hmm. How he treated the Chinese navvies who worked in the railways and the policies that he enacted after the railway was done with respect to the Chinese immigrants, what he did with respect to Aboriginal people, the Indigenous people, are still paying for. And so I think we should look at him with clear eyes and see that some of the things he did deserve to be admired. Some of the things he did were a sign of the times. He was a man of his times, and we deserve to feel shame. But the point of Sir John's Echo, the book that I've just written, is not to refight those battles, but to look at his original vision for the country. So I think a great many of the prime ministers respected that vision, worked according to that vision, and that vision that the prime ministers admired and worked to respect helped the country.
Now we're seeing in the world today a sort of ramp up of American style politics throughout the world, the sort of rhetoric that we're seeing from the United States. I mean, it very well could come to this country. I mean, aspects of it have. How do Canadians gird themselves against that?
Yeah, well, what we are seeing is a number of things with the rise of populism and the rise of negative nationalism. And we saw it in Brexit. We saw it reflected in the American election that gave us Mr. Trump, and we're seeing it in the French election that has Ms. Le Pen polling rather well. I think that, let me say, I hope that Canadians are immune from that type of populism. I think Canadian values are such that we do not see the other, however we define the other, the of another class, of another race, of another nationality, quite the same way as the voters that would vote in Brexit, that would vote in Mr. Trump. I believe, too, that we have economic structure and all of the programs that we have that mitigate some of the worst effects of the deindustrialization that has been tearing many cities in the United States apart, many cities in Britain apart. So for those reasons, I would like to think, I hope I'm right, that we are somewhat inoculated against the dangerous populism, nativism, negative nationalism that gave rise to those three phenomena. I know there are some candidates running for the Conservative leadership right now that are trying desperately to tap into that anger, but they seem to be finding little traction.
And we're seeing, just from a PR perspective, the brand of Canada seem to be doing well, and that has to do, I would assume, whether you voted for him or not, the current Prime Minister. It's popular to be Canadian. The country is seen, it's regarded highly, isn't it?
It is, and it deserves to be. A lot of Canadians seem to still have the notion that we are a brand new country and we're so young. But if one looks around the world, we see that we are one of the oldest countries in the world. If we've been going since 1867, there are many countries in the world that haven't been going since the 1960s, not the 1860s. Many that have been reconstituted in that they are just operating on a model around since the 1990s. Think about Russia and Germany. So we are one of the oldest countries in the world. We're one of the richest countries in the world. And again, if you look at what's happening with the United Kingdom and with the United States right now, we are one of the best countries in the world. So we have a great deal about which we deserve to feel proud as Canadians. And the other thing, I think it goes to the heart of what we are as Canadians, is we respect our own complexity. We don't see it as a weakness. We see our complexity as the basis of our strength. And I think it is that, more than anything else, that makes us immune to the people that would turn us against each other and turn us against the world. And again, it is the power of the federal government speaking for Canada that allows us to do that. Sir John would be very proud had he seen Justin Trudeau speaking at Vimy the other day. There is an example of the federal government speaking for Canadians about Canadian values.
As I told you before we started, such an engaging book, and I could talk all day with you about it. What's next for you as you continue?
Well, I'm working on my next book as we speak, despite the fact that this one has only come out in the last week. I'm proud of this one. I'm currently thinking a great deal about this one because I'm doing interviews and things, as you would expect with people like you, but I'm already at work in my next book.
Yeah, can you tell us at all? Or?
Well, I'd like to keep that to myself and just thinking about and just talk about Sir John's Echo right now because it'll be another year and a half before it sees the light of day.
Well, you know how much a fan I am of your work, and including this one. As I said, it's given me a lot to think about, especially with parts of it that I disagreed with, and you're starting a marvelous conversation in this 150th year of Canada.
Well, perfect. I am so happy to hear that you're enjoying it, and you know what? I am equally happy to hear that you were disagreeing with parts of it, because that's exactly what it's supposed to do. Not everybody agreed with Sir John. Not everybody agreed with Mr. Harper or Ms. Trudeau. and that's just the way it should be. But I guess my point is that Mr. Trudeau is very much speaking as if he is Sir John. He is essentially saying, this is the vision of Canada that I see, and it is Sir John's vision. That's why if you listen to what Mr. Trudeau says, no matter what he is saying, with what policy he's discussing, basically you hear that hint of a Scottish burr, because he is speaking, and it is Sir John's echo. And that's the title of the book.
Yeah. John, congratulations on this book. Continued good luck with it. It's been a pleasure speaking with you again.
Thank you very much. It's good to speak with you, and maybe in another year or so we'll speak again.
Absolutely.
The book is called Sir John's Echo, The Voice for a Stronger Canada. It is part of the Point of View series from Dundurn, from Lakefield, Ontario. I was joined on the line by John Boyko in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.